Well, the Lansing School District will have to wait until September 1st to learn the status of six Lansing schools from the State School Reform Office. It's not yet known whether these six schools will be among the bottom 5% of Michigan schools as measured by the MSTEP test, but according to today's Lansing State Journal, Natasha Baker of the School Reform Office said that she anticipated sharing good news with the district at a recent meeting, but apparently at the meeting about the status of these six schools, the school district showed up with its attorney, and the state did not want to proceed without its attorney. So Lansing waits to find out the status of the six schools that may be among the state's bottom 5%, according to the MSTEP test. We shall wait until September 1st for that. It's Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Deadly drunk driving crashes are a grim routine reality in Michigan and across the country. According to the organization MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, two out of three people will be involved in a drunk driving crash in their lifetimes. Still, MAD says some strides are being made here in Michigan. Current State's Brooke Allen is here with more. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Mark. Another compelling statistic. Every 2 minutes, a person is injured or killed in a drunk driving crash. So that means by the time this conversation is over, somebody will have been hurt. So I talked to Tyler McCachran, the Michigan State Executive Director for Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and heard some encouraging news. He says that in Michigan, people are starting to pay more attention to the deadly combination of drinking and driving.
Thankfully, the news is paying greater and greater attention to it. It's a completely preventable tragic occurrence. It's actually been at epidemic levels for, you know, since 1980 when Mothers Against Drunk Driving was created. And over the years, you know, they used to have as many as 30,000 people killed each year by drunk driving. And that's dwindled down nationally to a little over 10,000. But it's still, you know, right up there with homicides, which are usually sexier for the media to cover it. So there's 10,000 people or more each year killed by drunk drivers and about 15,000 that are killed in homicides. So it's incredibly, incredibly prevalent, and it's on the rise in Michigan.
And I know a recent study came out from Wallet Hub, and it described the most strict states and the most lenient states on DUIs, and it's surprising where Michigan actually fell in this survey.
We take it as a rallying call. We've done a lot of good work, a lot of prep work, and gotten some significant early legislation passed in Michigan that should very, very, in the near future, switch that in a much more positive direction. But for right now, you know, for example, there's 28 other states that have all offender ignition interlock legislation on the books, and that's been found to literally cut the fatalities from drunk driving in half once that's implemented. And Michigan has the high BAC or the super drunk, and the multiple time offenders are the only ones that can get that ignition interlock on their device. That's an in-car breathalyzer that makes it so that these offenders cannot operate their vehicle while they're intoxicated.
So Michigan does not have that right now for everybody.
Correct. And we've got legislation that was introduced by Representative Clint Kesto that is on the floor, and we're working with all of our partners in traffic safety, with Secretary of State, and with law enforcement to make sure after the summer break and the election season that that gets passed as quickly as possible, because it truly is our best legislative tool that we found.
And you know, something I did not know, and I just learned actually today, that sobriety checks are not allowed in Michigan.
Correct. Yep. They were found unconstitutional many, many years ago. And so it would take an act of the Michigan Supreme Court or the legislature to really do a comprehensive change to that. Or it would take, you know, for example, a retiring sheriff to knowingly do a sobriety checkpoint, knowing that it would be legally challenged and encouraging it to be legally challenged, and then have it go up through the Supreme Court to get that change. But yeah, unfortunately, we cannot do the sobriety checkpoints, which are very, very effective in other states. What we do is MAD will partner with local law enforcement and with the Office of Highway Safety Planning and do increased patrols so that and saturate the local media that, hey, these are taking place, especially on holiday weekends, which is when drunk driving fatalities across the nation spike. So we do that, but you know, other states have the ability to literally set up stops where every driver coming through, they do a sobriety check, and you know, it really, really increases awareness. And just like when you see the speed limit, you know, machines on the side of the road that tell you how fast you're going and what the speed limit is, you know, it curbs the behavior and it gets people to take notice. So we're that's one of the things, you know, after we get ignition interlock for all offenders in place, that we would love to get the political will behind giving our law enforcement that tool as well.
I am speaking to Tyler McCachran, the state executive director for MAD Michigan. Let's turn it a little bit. And I know that the case that is probably more on the forefront of people's minds, the little girl who was killed back at the end of July, Victoria Mack.
Yes.
And she was 12 years old. And she was killed by Charles James Cahill. He was a repeat offender. And he had been driving on a suspended license. I believe his license had been suspended since 1990.
Right.
More and more prevalent of what we hear in the media is the repeat offenders. How is that possible?
Well, there's a number of factors. The primary deterrent that was used before technologies like ignition interlock was the administrative privileges to drive. So the Secretary of State revoking those privileges and, you know, the law enforcement community shaking their fingers at the offenders and, you know, fining them and saying, oh, you can't drive now. Unfortunately, you know, as we all know, they just keep driving. It's a piece of paper to them. They're already breaking the law, and their only concern is getting from point A to point B, regardless of their level of intoxication. So, you know, there's a whole lot of very, very, very tragic incidences that, just like this Cahill one, where the law enforcement community has done their job. They've arrested this gentleman in his case. They arrested him, and he was convicted of DUIs 12 times before he finally took that 12-year-old's life. And you know, he was convicted. So the court system did their job, but the tools that were employed didn't keep the community safe. You know, he should not have been able to operate a vehicle, period. And the ignition interlock is something that has been found to be effective on that. We've had, just with the super drunk and the multiple time offenders that have had that on their cars over a recent 5-year period, nearly 90,000 attempts were made to start their vehicles breathing into that device when they were over the legal limit of 0.08. So almost 100,000 would have been trips that they would have taken while drunk, even though they're convicted and they have that device in their car. They're not using the same thought processes about personal and public safety that you know, the majority of people use.
So civilians are obviously not the only ones affected by drunk drivers. Actually, a state trooper just got hit last week, and a Hamburg officer was actually killed not too long ago by a drunk driver.
Correct. And at MAD, you know, we've actually honored officers 1 year only to have them lose their young children to a drunk driving crash the next year. So it impacts everybody. You know, over 300 people last year in Michigan lost their lives to drunk drivers. And, you know, law enforcement is already, you know, strong partners in doing everything that they can with their manpower to, you know, combat what you refer to as an epidemic. And I have to, you know, agree with it. You know, it isn't, you know, people that are deserving of something horrible happening to them. It's not people of any kind of socioeconomic or any other factor. It's just literally impacts all of us. You know, it's just these random, you know, giant metal carnage wreaking vehicles are out there, and they're destroying lives for the simple fact that people are not being responsible with their own safety and that of others.
You know, I can say, speaking from personal experience, and, you know, some people know this about me, some people don't, that my life and my daughter's life 12 years ago, just this past July, was affected by a drunk driver. We lost my husband and her father by a drunk driver back in California. And, you know, when that happened, you know, it's such a random act, and it's something that you just don't ever expect. You know, you just really don't know it's coming. So for the people out there, you know, who are affected by this, and the people out there who don't really understand how random it is, and when you do get behind the wheel, you know, you mentioned the machinery and the car and how powerful it is, and really you have no idea the responsibility that you have. Just when you get into a car every day when you go to work, you know, you take the keys and you're driving, and whether you're texting and driving or whether you run a red light or you're not paying attention, you're flipping the radio dial, you know, you really don't have any idea of the responsibility that you have in your hands. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was involved in a crash with, you know, my husband now and the twins, and four cars were involved, and it was actually pretty minor. But to be honest with you, that is my biggest fear, to be involved in a car accident with them. And, right. You know, immediately I jumped and I thought, oh, no, I can't believe this is happening, because you see the car coming at you. Of course, from my experience, that would be my first thought of, this is going to be awful. And
right.
For the people who are involved in these fatal car accidents, and you really don't know what is coming around the bend, and to be involved with something like this, it makes you think.
And for the survivors, like you were saying, I mean, literally years and years and years later, just because it is such a out of the blue, traumatic, violent thing that has happened. You know, first responders, you know, many of whom have served in the military as well, that's what they compare it to. I mean, it's like a war zone when you're coming on, you know, the carnage that's left after some of these crashes, you know, especially those that take lives. And, you know, many are dealing with, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder-like symptoms, and are very, very fearful as they're making their way around the roadways themselves. So it's you know, it's not just the person that's lost; it's the survivors that you know, still have a lot of grief and a lot of anxiety and just a lot of pain to work through. And that's something that MAD puts a lot of our energies into, is to helping that healing process, as well as to help those individuals through the court process, so that they're not victimized again as a result of that process.
And actually, a lot of people don't know that MAD actually offers grief support system. You guys are able to help people work through that as well. And
yep.
There is a national hotline that MAD offers.
Yeah, we offer a national hotline. We also offer free victim services throughout the state of Michigan. So we offer both support groups and grief workshops, but we also have one-on-one, very skilled social workers all over Michigan that will walk hand-in-hand with the people, not only through the court process, but through the grieving process. And really, as long as those families identify that they could use that support, we will stay engaged with them free of charge.
Hey, Tyler, thank you so much.
Yeah, you know, we do have a couple of our signature community awareness and capacity building events coming up this August 20th, Saturday, in Rochester Municipal Park. We have our Detroit area Walk Like MAD event, and on September 17th in Grand Rapids, 6th Street Bridge Park, we have our Grand Rapids Walk Like MAD event. And that's an opportunity for people that have been impacted by drunk driving, and those that really just don't want to be impacted by it, and you know, see the senselessness of it, to band together and put an end to it. It's law enforcement, it's traffic safety professionals, it's, you know, those that are serving people with addictions and trying to help them through that. And it's just community members. I mean, MAD was started by one mother that lost a child that said enough is enough, and really created a movement that's, you know, going strong, you know, nearly four decades later. So, you know, one person within a school system can completely change that environment, and you know, work with us on underage drinking prevention activities that are going to make it so that, you know, our kids are not at risk and are not growing up to be the drunk drivers of the future. It's really, you know, every person in the community at every level has something that they can do to make it a much safer Michigan.
Tyler McCachran, the State Executive Director for MAD Michigan.
Thank you, Brooke.
I'm Brooke Allen for Current State.
Cherry picking season may be over in Michigan, but a few weeks ago, one Michigan cherry farmer raised awareness about an issue that's still creating a buzz. Mark Santucci posted a picture to Facebook of all the tart cherries his Traverse City farm forced to spoil. The picture went viral. We'll talk with him about it and the whole story behind it on the way on Current State. One of Michigan's largest and most high-profile construction projects is steadily taking shape at Michigan State University. When it's finished, the facility for rare isotope beams will house a massive underground tunnel through which nuclear particles will flash at half the speed of light. Scientists will study the isotopes these particles create upon collision. MSU's hosting an open house at FRIB this Saturday, but Current State's Kevin Lavery took the tour a little early. Kevin, this thing has some impressive numbers.
Without a doubt, Mark. Here's a few of them. Four buildings encompassing 500,000 square feet, a main tunnel that's 570 feet long. Here's the best number of all. Civil construction is 10 weeks ahead of schedule. So I put on a hard hat and a safety vest this week to take a tour with Chris Tronson. He is the Deputy Director of Conventional Facilities and Infrastructure at FRIB. He's not a scientist, but working on this project every day has afforded him a lot of knowledge about what FRIB really is.
We're actually accelerating isotopes at 53% of the speed of light. They hit a target. They can break them down into smaller, more finite pieces and particles that they can study to further our advanced knowledge of science.
And that can be good for the medical field, for security, many different uses.
Yes. One of the things, to me, that the homeland security is definitely a component. I think the medical research is very important. We use isotopes in everyday medical applications like CAT scans or stress tests, having the ability to find better, more efficient isotopes that will work for those applications and potentially cure cancer.
It's amazing how we have this huge facility, lots of people, lots of time, lots of money spent on this to look for things that are microscopic.
That's correct. Right now, the United States leads the world in science, and this machine gives us the ability to maintain our knowledge base and our competitive advantage in the field of science. This is a service building. It's going to hold about 800 racks. It's going to look like a data center when it's done. We're standing on a raised access floor that's about 2 feet above the concrete floor. There's cooling water underneath that's fed up to cool the racks, as well as air conditioning units that blow air down through the raised access floor, acts like a plenum. The cold air blows up through the racks to cool off the different components.
And what exactly are on the racks?
So there's many components. They look like a stereo amplifier. Some of them are for diagnostics, some of them for controls, some of them are power. A lot of them produce radio frequency waves. Radio frequency waves is one of the ways that they use to accelerate the beam. So right now we're standing in the front end building. We have two high voltage platforms. On each platform is where the magic starts. This is where the beam line starts. So each one of these platforms produces 100,000 volts of electricity. There's a plasma, it agitates the plasma, and then magnetically they use it to start the beam line. It goes down this drop shaft down into the tunnel. We use them at the bottom. There's a magnet that turns the beam line to go horizontal, vertical, and then it'll travel throughout the beam line. So we produce a lot of heat. So a lot of the things are cooled just so they don't overheat. So these rafts here, all the stainless steel piping you see is just for cooling down the components.
Cooling seems to be very central to this entire thing.
Yes, it does produce a tremendous amount of heat. So you're dealing with a lot of different various energies, and you know, we need to make sure that things are kept at a cool level so they work efficiently, just like any electronic stuff.
We're heading down some concrete stairs, and it's very echoey in here, and I can already feel the temperature getting cooler. We're heading into the belly of the beast.
Right now, we're 32 feet below grade, and we're standing on about 4 feet of concrete. So now we're in the tunnel itself. This is the bottom of the vertical beam drop that we spoke of previously. This tunnel is 570 feet long, 70 feet wide, 14 feet tall. We're standing on 4 feet of concrete. The walls are 3 feet thick. The lid is 4.5 feet thick at the center, and it's sloped, so it's about 4 feet on the outside. We have a 28-inch copper grid that completely wraps the floors, the walls, the ceiling, so everything's grounded, so we keep noise out and keep noise from admitting out or other noise from the outside coming in.
You know, when you talk about the dimensions of this facility, Chris, 570-foot long tunnel, 70 feet wide, this is very, very precise work. I mean, we're talking about, again, splitting microscopic atoms for some scientific purposes. How do we know the precise specifications to build everything?
Well, there's two different things that are in play. First of all, the people that it's like building a car. There's different people that work on different components of this machine that are literally experts, the world's leading experts at what they do. We also collaborate the Department of Energy twice a year. Every 6 months, we are reviewed by other laboratories from around the United States of people that have already built similar types of machines and labs and know how they know what works and what doesn't work. And they review our project to make sure we're on track, make sure we're doing the right thing, make suggestions on how to improve things, how to make things better. So we have a system that works really, really well for us. And so far, everything's been incredibly successful.
We're talking with Chris Tronson, who is the Deputy Director of Conventional Facilities and Infrastructure for FRIB, the Facility for Rare Isotope Beams at Michigan State. Chris, how often do you have to translate to people what they're seeing in a way that's concrete?
Well, we've been giving tours to the public once a week on Wednesday afternoons. And there's people that have a knowledge base and that are familiar with other projects like CERN that and they have an interest in this. And then other people, this is kind of new to them. So it depends on the person and what their knowledge base is and kind of break it down from there. But, you know, it's been explained. One of the things that I really love about this project is learning new things about science and physics. And I learn new stuff every day. All the people that I work with, they're some of the most brilliant minds I've ever been around in my life. Most of them are professors. They love to teach, and that includes me. So I learn new things, and I really love that about this project.
So this is the type of place that you can see what's happening around you, but you can't really visualize this unless you think about this from an intellectual level and appreciate the science behind all this infrastructure.
Yes, and we do have a website for FRIB that explains how a lot of it works, and anybody has more questions, I'd encourage them to go to that website. It gives more detail and explains how things work. It's absolutely fascinating. So there's a few more things that are worth pointing out. If you look above the ceiling, you'll see that there's layers and layers and layers of cable tray, and there's fire protection, and there's electrical, and there's conduits. You can see how well everything fits because we had models that showed we knew that there was enough clearance that it was going to work. So building everything in the model has been a huge asset for the project and increased our productivity. And not to mention, we have the best contractors and the best tradesmen in the state working on this project, so the quality is unsurpassed. It's unbelievable.
That was my next question. There must be a huge number of contractors. Are they all here in Michigan or at least in the United States?
99% of our workers' zip codes are in Michigan. So we have a construction management company, Barton Mellow, out of Southfield. Our architect, Smith Group's out of Detroit. Everybody else is, we really pride ourselves on the fact that we have all this local involvement. And the people that work on the project, we have 244 people who are on site Friday. They're all excited about it, and they all are very proud to have the opportunity to participate on this project because everybody's making a wonderful contribution.
Chris Tronson is the Conventional Facilities Deputy Director and Project Engineer for the Facility for Rare Isotope Beams, the FRIB project at Michigan State University, which is conducting an open house of the new FRIB facility, which is still in construction. Chris, thank you so much for taking me on a tour of Deep Inside FRIB.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it. Come on out Saturday if you want to see more. There's a lot more. It's well worth it.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Labrie.
And coming up on Current State, as public schools start getting ready to begin another school year, meet the new Michigan Art Teacher of the Year. Sharon Stratton teaches in the West Michigan town of Fenville. That and more after the break on Current State. Well, that's Stan and Ben wailing about those old farmhouse blues. They were our Live Music Friday guests back in February here on Current State. Tomorrow, we welcome Michael Dees to Studio S. Michael teaches trombone in the MSU College of Music's Jazz Studies program. He has played with the likes of Christian McBride, Roy Hargrove, Alicia Keys, and Paul Simon. Michael Dees tomorrow on Live Music Friday here on Current State. We hope you can join us. Well, we Michiganders take our cherries very seriously, so it's no surprise that when Traverse City farmer Mark Santucci revealed a photo of the massive amount of cherries his farm was required to spoil, it caused a big stir. We wanted to understand what was going on with these cherries, so we invited Mark to stop by yesterday to tell us the whole story. So a few weeks ago, you posted a picture here to Facebook with a huge mound of beautiful bright red tart cherries on the ground with a caption that said you were required by law to let them spoil. And this post was shared over 65,000 times. Explain why you had to spoil those cherries.
There is something called the Orderly Marketing Agreement for Tart Cherries. And what the agreement says is that a board is set up to oversee not so much the production, but the consumption of the cherries. And this board determines whether or not they believe there's a surplus of cherries or not. If they believe there's a surplus of cherries, then the processor and or the farmer has to restrict the supply by whatever percentage the board comes out with. The percentage this year was 30%. My processor said he will hold 16% in reserve, but I needed to put 14% on the ground. So that's how the number was arrived at.
Well, this arrangement, though, it's aimed at helping ensure that you, the farmer, and also the processor, apparently can make more money off the cherries. Is that the aim of the regulation?
That is the intent of the regulation. The problem is the world has changed since 1937 when the law came into effect, and since 1995 when the latest cherry marketing order came into effect. We have, over most of our history, been either import-export neutral or a net exporter of tart cherry products up until about 2008. Starting around 2008, 2009, we started importing cherries, and those numbers have increased continually to the point where in 2015, 40% of our total consumption here in the U.S. of tart cherry products were imported.
So are you suggesting we stop or at least reduce the importation of cherries?
No. I'm a free trader by background. I think we can compete with the imported products as long as they're not being subsidized. And to date, I haven't seen any information which would tell me they are. The problem is they're coming from Turkey, Hungary, Poland, Bulgaria, Romania. Those are all low-cost, low-wage countries. The land is a lot cheaper than it is here where we grow our cherries. So we do have competition that's from a lower-cost source. However, they have to ship the products from there to here. So I believe that if allowed to compete without one hand tied behind our back, we might lose some market share to them, but I don't believe we'd lose 40% of the market share to them.
So that number needs to be readjusted? That 14% should be lower than, I take
right.
it?
Right. We could cover that for if we didn't drop 14% of our cherries, if we didn't restrict 30% of our cherries, because restriction means you can't sell them. You have to keep them off the market. we're only talking about 100 million tons, and we're already importing 200 million tons. So even if every one of our cherries could be sold on into the market, we would still import 100 million pounds worth of cherries. What I'm saying is, why are we restricting those 100 million pounds when we're importing 200 million pounds?
Is there a consensus among Michigan's tart cherry farmers? Do most of them feel the same way you do?
There's not a consensus. If you look at it from the perspective of the number of farmers that feel like I do, I believe yes. The problem becomes when the way this is voted on, it's not one man or one person, one vote. It's 1 pound, one vote. So I produce 300,000 pounds of tart cherries. There's a guy across the bay from me who produces 20 million pounds of tart cherries. So he gets 20 million votes to my 300,000 votes. Mm. And the large producers are also processors. So they game the system in that way, in that if the prices are low, they'll make it on the processing side. If the prices are high, they'll make it on the production side. So you'll find that most, not all, but most of the large producers slash processors are in favor of this, because what it allows them to do is to have, over the long term, a more stable price. Not necessarily a more favorable price, but a more stable price. You talk to the farmers like myself, and I've had many of them contact me since that post went viral, and they are in agreement with what I've been saying.
We're talking with Traverse City cherry farmer Mark Santucci. He's actually a resident much of the year of East Lansing, but he does his cherry farming in Traverse City. We're talking about regulations and rules that mean he must destroy some of his tart cherry crop. What happens to the cherries you destroy then?
They become compost for the trees.
Oh, okay.
And the fruit flies, food for the fruit flies.
And you're not allowed to give any of them away?
You can give them away, but first of all, you need prior permission, and you really need a processor to work with, because tart cherries have between a 1 and 2 day shelf life. So you just can't bring a couple thousand pounds of cherries into your nearest food bank and say, okay, pit them, freeze them, make pies with them. A processor has to do it. There's a cost to the processor. After having been through this, if this happens next year, I am going to find a way to donate some of my crop to different organizations. And in fact, I'm talking with a friend of mine who owns a company called Cherry Capital Foods, and they distribute all over the state Michigan food products. He's talking to an organization that's called Farm to Freezer, and we're going to work with them, and we're going to come up with a solution for some of them. But we're talking about millions of pounds, and you're talking about literally a couple days where you need a solution. So for me, I will find a solution. But that leaves a number of other farmers and a lot of cherries that won't have a solution.
Why do you think your post was shared so many times?
I think a couple of reasons. One, the most response I got was the wasting of the food. People just couldn't understand. They couldn't figure it out. They couldn't understand why I couldn't donate it. They couldn't understand why I was forced to put it on ground. Many didn't believe me. The second most responses were related to government interfering, government regulations. So it was interesting looking at these things that there's two large groups that approach it from two different directions.
How is the law enforced? I mean, how would the authorities know if you sold or donated the cherries?
They know for two reasons. One, before I put one cherry on the ground, they have representatives come out to my farm, and we shake about 10 trees and fill up our bins, and they measure how many pounds of cherries from those 10 trees went into those bins. From that, they determine how many trees I need to shake on the ground in order to equal to 14% of my crop. Then I need a special machine to shake the trees, so they just go on the ground. After that is done, we contact them, and This time, 2 days later, they came and they inspected the ground to make sure the cherries were shaken and left there and not used in some other purpose.
So what can be done? I understand the farmers are the ones who vote on whether this program continues.
I think what we need to do is we need to get the board itself to realize that imports are a major factor in everything that happens in the tart cherry industry. They can't ignore the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that's what they've been doing up until this point in time. So we need to, as farmers and as other interested parties, we need to keep bringing this up, putting pressure on to get them to do that. In the best of all worlds, I wouldn't have this agreement. But, we do have the agreement, so now we have to make the agreement work as best as possible. And the way to do that is to recognize the world as it is, not as what we would like it to be.
We've been talking with Traverse City cherry farmer Mark Santucci about regulations that mean he needs to destroy some amount of his tart cherry crop. Mark Santucci, thank you.
Thank you.
Current state. Daily on 90.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. Catch us online at WKAR.org. While Michigan parents are getting ready for the start of the school year, teachers are doing the same thing. Current State's Jamie Paisley just spoke with one teacher in West Michigan who received a fantastic surprise a few weeks ago.
The Michigan Art Education Association named their Art Teacher of the Year for Michigan a couple weeks ago, and it is Sharon Stratton of the Fenville School District. And Sharon, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
So how big is Fenville as a district? It's fairly small, right?
Yes, Fenville is. We have, in the high school, for example, we have about 400 students. I think the whole district is less than 1,200.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's a very small district.
And that's, you're located on the west end of Michigan, kind of just below Holland. Is that about right?
Yes, that's correct. It's close to Saugatuck is how I describe it to a lot of people.
So for the people that you've told that you are now the Michigan Art Teacher of the Year for this year, I'm assuming not many of them are surprised.
Well, they appear not to be. They say, oh, you know, you're deserving. I was very surprised. But very happy.
And I know you're, if I read this correctly, you're coming up on a decade, essentially, in Fenville, right?
Yes, I am. This is my 10th year. It's kind of a long story, and feel free to cut me off if it takes too long. But I really, when I went to high school, I came from a very artistic background. My mother is an artist. She's a fine artist. I was always challenged to do the same when I was in high school. I kind of followed that path. I went to Kendall College of Art and Design in Grand Rapids for illustration, and I didn't actually finish. I went for 3 years and then was kind of charmed away from that by money and a position at an exhibit company that I was working at, and I thought, oh, I'll go back. But at the time, I was just getting married, and it seemed like a very good job offer. So I left and went, was in that business, came back after 20 years, after two children, marriage, and just a whole life apart. And then I decided to go back to Kendall to, what I was thinking was to finish my illustration degree. And I walked in the office and looked at the office of the registrar to see which of my credits would transfer and, you know, if they were all still good. And I saw this brochure for art education, and it was just like an epiphany kind of. And I imagined that it just jumped out at me, and I was a different person then. I was a mother, and I had been a Girl Scout leader. And I saw this, and I thought, this is so much more me now than it used to be. So anyways, that's kind of how I got into education, but it was a not normal path.
Yeah. I know that we're coming up on the first day of school, and yes, I know teachers may not want to talk about it quite yet, but it's coming upon us. Fenville's first day is September 6th, and you're having an open house on the 30th. I want you to place yourself as if you were one of the ninth graders coming in for the first time. How would you describe your classroom in Fenville? Like, what's the thing that would catch the student's eye first?
Well, I think the thing that catches their eye, it's a place where everybody's safe, where it's a judgment-free zone. It's a place where students, they learn that there's many right answers, not just one. You know, it's not just the one answer that's in the back of the book. There's many right answers to a problem. And that's liberating for kids because they say, what? Mine doesn't have to be, you know, like the same as everybody else's. So I guess that's how I see what they would see as they walk in.
The student experience.
And it's a happy place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Sharon Stratton, the newly named, newly minted even, I guess you could say, Michigan Art Teacher of the Year, so named by the Michigan Art Education Association. Also, I know that you frequently bring your students outside, or their pieces, the ones that are interested in art. You've involved them with Art Prize, from what I understand, as well as, if I read correctly, the Fenville Goose Festival had a student art display as well.
Yes, those are a few of the things. Those happen right away in almost the first month of school. Art Prize is, that will be happening. The field trip to that will be 2 or 3 weeks into the school year. And then the Goose Fest Art Show, it's a festival that happens in Fenville every year. And it's held at, the art show is held at the local library. Mm-hmm. And it's almost a mini Art Prize. People go through and they're able to vote for their favorite piece. And so it's really a cool thing. We have lots of kids get honorable mentions. So those are a couple of things. But I love field trips. I love getting kids out of the walls of the school. We do something in the spring. We do a pit firing, which is we go to a farm of a local potter, and we fire pottery in the ground, kind of like a bonfire, but it's a bonfire that burns for a few days.
Yeah.
So just really cool experiences that the kids wouldn't have otherwise.
You mean like an old-fashioned kiln, essentially?
It is. It is an old-fashioned kiln, but it's literally in, you know, like underground.
Yeah.
So it's neat.
There is often, at least you know, as you hear about education and budget cuts that seems to be happening, just doing more with less. How has kind of the administration of Fenville been, like Principal Jim Graydanis? I'm sure he's thrilled to have you as there, and how does that impact your position?
He's very supportive. He really is a great principal to work for. I am very budget conscious, and I try not to spend money that I don't need to spend. I use supplies that are there. It challenges me to see what can I do with them. People will bring me things. I see what I can do. But when I do need to spend money, he's very supportive. He knows that it's great because he recognizes that cool things are happening in the art room and that you can't do some of those things without, you know, new paper and good paper. You know, glazes, and he's very good about that. So it does help that good things happen in the art room. But yeah, I definitely receive support from administration.
We're speaking with Sharon Stratton, the newly named Michigan Art Teacher of the Year. And I know part of that also involves that you're going to be invited to speak at the Art Education Conference that's coming up in Traverse City, kind of the end of October. And then I believe you're also going to then head to the National Convention.
Yeah, The National Convention is in New York this year, and it is in March of 2017. So, yes, I will be attending that, and there's a nice ceremony for the different art educators of the year from the different states. So I'm looking forward to that.
Are you ready to speak in front of the colleagues for the conference as well? Because I think that's part of it as well, yes?
Yeah, it's a great group to be in front of. At the state level, I have a little experience with that because I actually was one of the co-chairs that brought the conference to the state last year. So I had several opportunities to get up and, you know, talk about what was on the agenda for the day or to introduce people. The part that will be different is to be accepting this award. So it's more about me. And so, you know, I'm a little scared, but I'm sure it will be fine.
We've been speaking with Sharon Stratton, the Michigan Art Teacher of the Year for 2016 and 2017, coming up into the new academic year. You're teaching at the Fenville Public School District at the high school level. So Sharon, thanks very much for coming with us. Congrats on the honor, and good luck heading into the school year.
Oh, thank you very much, Jamie. I appreciate it.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Last week, Current State listeners heard storytellers open up on the theme, The Call of the Wild, at Valley Court Park in East Lansing, and we certainly heard some wild stories. This story was from Jay Wager. It's about an unexpected encounter on a Japanese beach.
Well, just remember, this could happen to anyone. So, for about 2.5 years, my wife, who's present, and my 4 kids and I, we lived in Japan. And we lived on the west coast of Japan, and we were about 1 mile from the Sea of Japan, and we liked to go to the beach. One day we went to the beach, and my wife and I were sitting on the blanket with our 2 daughters, who were just about 2 and just about 4, and the boys, who were 7 and 9, are running up and down the beach and playing in the water, and I'm keeping my eye on them, and I noticed there's this Japanese man with a pail, and my 2 kids are looking in the pail, and I'm thinking, maybe I should check this out. So I amble over and I look down into the pail, and there's an octopus in the pail. And when the man sees me, he lifts the octopus out of the pail, and it's kind of about maybe tip to tip, it'd be like 14 inches. And it's kind of hanging there limp in his hand, but its tentacles are moving a little bit, so I know it's still alive. And he holds it out to me, and my Japanese isn't good enough at that point to say, you're a crazy man, get that away from me. So I just shook my head no. And my older son shook his head no. And my younger son, who loves everything that lives, held out his hand. And the man placed the octopus in his hand, and it seemed to come to life and wrapped all its tentacles around his arm. Not good. But I paused for a moment to think, and, you know, what do you do when you get an octopus on your hand? And I kind of ran it through the, you know, great data bank that is your brain and came back with insufficient data, no response. So I look back at my son, and he's still smiling, and I'm saying, hey, this could have a good resolution. He's happy, and hopefully the man will take the octopus and go away. And just at that time, he starts screaming, it's biting me, it's biting me! And octopi, if you don't know, have a little beak like a parrot. And so it's, you know, biting his hand. And I run it through my brain again. What do you do when you get an octopus on your hand? Got nothing. So I grabbed a couple tentacles and grabbed a couple more tentacles, and there's still more tentacles there. So I let go of this hand, and they wrap back around, and I let go of this hand, they wrap back, so I'm grabbing tentacles, and it just, they got a lot of tentacles. And so then I got to the point of panic, and I just didn't know what to do, so I grabbed its head. And octopi don't have a skull, so it's like grabbing his brains. So he let go then, went limp, and I had him, and I put him back in the pail. So now, if you ever find yourself with an octopus on your hand, you know what to do. If the octopus is over 10 feet in length, results may vary. Thank you.
And be sure to join us for our next Pop-Up Stories event 2 weeks from I beg your pardon. It is 1 week from next Wednesday, August the 31st, 6 p.m. We gather at Red Cedar Spirits, Merritt Road, East Lansing. The theme is The Heat Is On. We're looking for more storytellers to sign up. So if you've got a story to tell along the theme of The Heat Is On, email us, please, currentstate@wkar.org. You can also learn more at our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing, and like it while you're at it. Thank you. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, Donald Trump is making another campaign stop here in Michigan. Tomorrow, the GOP presidential nominee will speak at the Summit Sports Complex. Near Lansing, the polls show Donald Trump trailing Hillary Clinton in Michigan, and the candidate's national campaign is again under new leadership. We'll talk about what the Trump campaign needs to get done in Michigan and how it might do that in Michigan and nationally with Trump's Michigan campaign director, Scott Hagerstrom. Plus, our live Music Friday guest, Michael Dees, a world-class trombone player who teaches in the MSU College of Music's Jazz Studies program. His most recent album is Father Figure. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. The executive producer of Peter Wharf is the executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. There we go. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, informative, insightful, indispensable with everything going on around mid-Michigan and beyond. Find it anytime, anywhere at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. We're on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. We hope to see you on Live Music Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR.